Welcome back to Palisade Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrix. Joining me today is a new guest on the show, Craig Hemke from tfmetalsreport.com. He also is the host of the Sprott Weekly Wrap-Up. How are you today, Craig?
Tom, I'm fine, thank you. It's a pleasure to visit with you, and I'm thrilled to be here on your site.
Well, we're really happy to have you. You have a lot to say, and I'd like to get to it. Why don't we start by getting a little bit of your thoughts on Powell's recent speech from Jackson Hole. We saw that they're seeming to try and get ahead of the inflation idea, and I'd like to kind of get your thoughts how they're going to try and average out, let's say, inflation over a certain time period.
Well, I think the announcement in that speech last week was kind of plowing the field for what's coming at the September FOMC in a couple of weeks, and we'll probably get another step along this path revealed to us then. What Powell was really trying to say last week was that he wants everybody to know he's not raising rates, and he's trying to express it every way possible to get this through everyone's heads. You know, they've explicitly stated at the FOMC meetings and in his press conferences that they're not going to hike rates through at least 2022. That's 2.5 years from now, because they know the damage the lockdowns and COVID have done to the U.S. economy is, I mean, it's not going to be something we come right. There's no V-shaped recovery. You're not just going to come right back. Even with the jobs that have been gained back in the last couple of months, we're still down like 11 million because we lost so many in April, and businesses are still struggling. So Powell just wants everybody to know there's not going to be any rate hikes anytime soon at all, because the market thinks, you know, as soon as you get to 2% inflation, they're going to be starting to think about interest rate hikes. So the way he was trying to make this point last week was saying, okay, now we're going to average inflation going forward, not just have this one single, you know, monthly or quarterly target, meaning that inflation could go to 3%. But yet if last year it was 1%, the average is still just 2%, and we don't have to raise rates now. This is really important, because what he's trying to do is spark inflation through their policies, because the best way you can pay off today's debt and yesterday's debt is through the cheaper currency of tomorrow. This is how the Fed managed the situation 70, 80 years ago, when GDP to debt got this high after World War II. They inflated it away. They placed on yield curve control, rate caps from 1942 to 1951, and they managed to bring it down by inflation and growing the economy and all that kind of stuff. That's what they're going to try to do here too. And what's most important for precious metals investors in this big picture, and again, part of this is going to be revealed at that FOMC in September, because what the Fed is going to be doing is institutionalizing, at least for a while, sharply negative real interest rates. And negative real interest rates over time, I mean, I'm talking over decades, have proven to be the primary driver of the gold price, and then by extension, silver. We got to a low, multi-year, multi-decade low in real interest rates back in the earlier part of August, and that's when gold was near $2,100. If we start moving even lower in real interest rates in the months and years ahead, gold's just going to keep climbing. And there's some fundamental reasons for that. But anyway, that's a very long answer to your short question, Tom. Yeah, but Powell is trying to convince everybody he wants inflation, and that he's not going to be raising interest rates anytime soon as part of the scheme to manage, you know, all of this massive debt and deficit.
Yeah, and one of the good indicators that you speak about is the TIP ETF as being a good proxy for real interest rates. And I think that's really important to really highlight the difference between real interest rates and the nominal interest rates. But I looked at it this morning, and the TIP ETF is at an all-time high. So the last time we saw at the beginning of August, what was the gold price? And explain to us a little bit about what we could see, considering that we're sitting at a new high for the TIP ETF.
Yeah. Long term, again, the best driver for gold prices is real interest rates. If you have a Bloomberg terminal, the way you can measure real interest rates in real time is just simply subtracting the inflation rate, the current inflation rate, from the 10-year treasury rate. That got to negative 1.1%. Back on August the 6th, and that's when gold was 2,100. If you don't have a Bloomberg terminal, the best way you can track it really as a proxy is this ETF with the symbol TIP, T-I-P. It holds nothing but Treasury inflation protected securities, and it goes up as real rates fall, and it falls as real rates go up. Well, when real rates hit that low at negative 1.1% and gold was nearly $2,100, that TIP was about pushing toward 127. Well, now here we are, basically 4 weeks later, and now the TIP fell to about 125, and now it's back to 127. But gold is still at least, what, $100 below where it was in August. And I think there's a reason for this, and it gets back to Powell and these inflation expectations, because the other part of this equation are those nominal rates, okay, the actual 10-year yield. Well, back in early August, that thing was pushing down toward 50, like 51, 52. And as we speak, it's more like 70, 71, 72, okay? And I think that's what is holding gold back. Instead of them all moving together, think of them as different spokes just for the time being. Because Powell has said he's going to be trying to spark inflation, okay? But they haven't announced yield curve control yet. And so the bond market looks at it and says, some future inflation perhaps. And nominal yields have risen, like I said, from 50 to 70. The tip market, as viewed by that ETF, isn't looking at whether there's inflation or not right now. It's kind of looking forward and expecting future inflation. And so the tip is rallying as well. And gold just has kind of caught in between, that nominal rates are climbing a little bit, but the tip is going up as well. And therefore, it's kind of getting pulled both ways. Let's see what happens, Tom, when we get, like I said, to this next FOMC in September. There have been hints, and the Fed has hinted at this beginning in June, that they're studying placing yield curve control on, yield caps on the 10-year. Again, they've done it in the past. The Fed has put out research papers showing how it has been effective in the past for helping to manage the debt. It may just be an announcement that they're actually doing it, Tom. I mean, if you pull up a chart of the 10-year yield since QE to infinity began, you know, in late March, looks like we're already in yield curve control. I mean, it's been in a band between 60 and 75 basis points now for 5 months. But the next shoe to drop will be an announcement that they are actually moving in this direction, or they're actually going to announce it. And then that's when all of these things probably fall back in line.
Yeah, it seems there's so many things that are just kind of waiting to break loose. And I actually saw that chart of what, like you say, looks like yield curve control right now. Something else I'd like to get your thoughts on. There was a conversation that you were referring to about central banks calling in as much debt as they can, owning corporate and sovereign debt, and then trying to nationalize it, write it off, and mark up gold. So if we actually see this happen, are only the countries that hold a lot of gold able to really capitalize on this type of situation? Obviously, we know that Canada really doesn't hold any gold anymore, and the US, their gold reserves haven't been audited since the 50s or 60s. So how do you see that situation going forward?
Yeah, at least in Canada, there's a lot of gold in them that are hills up there, right? So maybe you can dig some out and replenish your official holdings. Yeah, that was, I think you're referring to an interview I did back in June with Luke Groman, who some folks might be familiar with. And he mentioned that that's kind of what one way of looking at the Fed buying everything at this point, because they're even buying corporate bonds of Apple, you know, and Microsoft and Google. I mean, what? Why do they need Fed to support their corporate bond price? And his idea was that they're just basically calling in all of this treasury debt and corporate debt and then going to maybe allow the gold price to reset higher. It's an interesting idea. I thought it was interesting at the time. Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure that that's like the actual plan they're trying to put into place. To me, I just see the Fed doing everything they can to keep the plate spinning, because they just cannot allow liquidity to seize up. They can't allow the markets to seize up. They can't allow the money markets to seize up, the bond markets to seize up, all this kind of stuff. And so they're just constantly pumping out cash now. And it kind of gets back to the mistake that they were making as they were trying to convince everybody that things were going back to normal from 2013 to 2018. You know, they sat there and said, we're going to trim the balance sheet. We're going to go back to normal, and rates are going to go back to normal. And a lot of people actually bought it. I didn't think they could ever do that. I mean, I thought it was ridiculous that was ever going to be able to happen, that they couldn't possibly, because they can't allow higher interest rates. Not only because of what it would do on the private side, you know, mortgages and credit card debt, you know, and corporate debt and all this kind of stuff, but just simply the accumulated interest on the U.S. federal debt would become unmanageable if rates suddenly went back to, say, 5%. I mean, that line item alone in the federal budget would be, you know, a couple trillion dollars a year. I mean, it makes everything just spin out of control that much faster. So this notion that they were going to ever normalize things was just crazy. Over 5 years, they were able to pair off about $700 billion worth of their balance sheet. But then that quickly reversed beginning last fall. And now, you know, what have they added? You know, $4 trillion or something so far this year because they're monetizing everything. The markets all seized up at the end of it all in November of 2018. You may recall that, Tom. You know, I mean, the stock market started to crash in December of 2018. And it was that point everything turned. That was when all of a sudden rates had to start falling again. That was when actually real interest rates started to plunge. If you pull up a chart of that TIP, TIP, that ETF, you can see that thing bottomed out in November of 2018. And everything's been going forward this way ever since. And again, the Fed just simply cannot allow things to seize up. And so that kind of puts them in a bind. I mean, they're now buying corporate debt and corporate bond ETFs and all this kind of stuff where they never have before, to protect against these various collapses. The only thing they haven't done yet is buy equities, you know, like the Bank of Japan or the Swiss National Bank. They say that they're not allowed to by charter, but that can be changed. And I would imagine if we ever get into a situation where the stock market starts to crash again, that'll be the next shoe to drop. So they're just too vested in trying to keep the system afloat. And that keeps us where we are and keeps us going forward. And I think a pretty solid foundation for the metals.
Yeah, absolutely. A solid foundation for the metals for sure. And speaking of the metals, I'd like to get your thoughts. You know, you've been writing about this stuff for 10 years, and you seem to understand really what happened with the short squeeze. Let's take the silver price, for example, in 2011. So could you explain a little bit about what happened there to us and maybe some of the similarities to the situation we find ourselves in right now?
Yeah, you know, I guess I was about to say I'm fortunate. Sometimes I wonder if I'm fortunate that I know all this stuff or not, because it's been a long 10 years. I think it's aged me about 30. But I guess I'm fortunate in that I was doing this. TF Metals Report began in November of 2010. And obviously the first half of 2011 was just crazy. And then we wandered in the desert for 5 or 6 years from 13 to 19. But back in 2011, it was wrongly thought at the time, and you're hearing this again now for crying out loud, Tom, that somehow it was a speculative bubble, you know, that silver was in a bubble and it was due to crash and pop and all this kind of stuff. And that was not shown at all to be true at the time. Some of the dots we can now connect, you know, with 10 years hence, you know, right before Bart Chilton passed away, Bart being one of the CFTC commissioners at the time. He gave an interview to Chris Marcus. You can find it at his website, Arcadia Economics. Bart knew he was dying. We know that now because he had pancreatic cancer and didn't have long to live. And he gave this interview to Chris. It was almost like a deathbed confession. He laid it all out. He said, here's what happened in 2008, and confirmed a lot of the stuff that has always been, I guess, theorized by some of the precious metals analysts, that JP Morgan bought Bear Stearns and assumed their massive short position in silver. The CFTC gave them 90 days or something like that to get rid of that short position. And JP Morgan instead found it as an easy way to make money because silver had been crashing during the financial crisis. And not only did they not eliminate it, they actually expanded it. The problem is at the time, JP Morgan didn't have a vault. They didn't have a COMEX silver vault at all. And so they were just naked short. They didn't have any actual silver. They were just playing the paper game. Price began to rally and they began to get squeezed. And when I said that there was no spec squeeze at the time, the CFTC data, and I don't even know if you can still find this stuff anymore, but if you go back and look at the commitment of traders reports from the last part of that move, when silver went from 38 to 48 in April of 2011, it was a commercial short squeeze. The speculator category was actually liquidating longs. The rally was the commercial category getting squeezed and having to cover their shorts, this probably being JP Morgan, because again, all these dots we can now connect. And then we got to $48, $49. Then we all know what happened on May the 1st. And then, you know, with the looks like now spoofing that smashed the price on May the 1st, 2011. We know the Department of Justice is investigating that period, right? And JP Morgan traders have been charged under the RICO Act with manipulating prices. Scotiabank just admitted and paid fines 2 weeks ago for manipulating, spoofing the precious metals during that time period. In that settlement, they admitted to doing it, quote, thousands of occasions. So what probably happened on May the 1st, 2011 was a massive spoofing thing. that smash price about $6 or $7 in like 15 minutes. And then the CME piled on with 5 margin hikes in 9 days. And, you know, the rest is history. JP Morgan, that spring, as this was taking place, was suddenly rubber stamped and approved to start their own vault. And now in the 7 or 8 years since, by regularly stopping silver deliveries, taking delivery of COMEX silver every 2 months, they've acquired about 150 million ounces. Well, they had. Now they have about 120. So anyways, it's been an interesting time, but that's a very long answer, again, to your question. But back in 2011, that was a short squeeze. It's a little bit different from what we've seen now in that I don't think that's the case at all. We're just simply seeing maybe those same banks being reticent to add shorts. We haven't seen a lot of increased speculator activity in COMEX silver either through the month of July and August while price went up 50%. So we're not anywhere near a speculative bubble now either. I can go into some of that data if you want, but I think that's important for people to understand. Just because price has risen, you know, you might be able to say Tesla's in a bubble because it's gone up like tenfold or something. But just because silver went up 50% in 5 weeks does not mean it's like, you know, every shoe shine boy and cab driver is buying silver.
Yeah, absolutely. And we can look at that. And I saw a stat this morning that even the 2011 inflation adjusted price for silver high would be somewhere around $300. And we're sitting at 29-ish somewhere in there this morning, yeah. Right? But I think something that ties into that, obviously, is hopefully we can kind of see this coming is a COMEX default. What are your thoughts on that? And maybe get into some of the data that you and Eric discussed quite a bit on the week in review there about how many ounces per year of silver that are produced, how many the COMEX takes, and, you know, even how much the ETFs take, kind of where that all goes and what that basically coming shortfall shows us.
Yeah, there's definitely a shortage at the wholesale level. I don't deal in the wholesale level, but I know a lot of people that do. And I hear all kinds of interesting anecdotal stories. Andrew McGuire, he's a wholesaler, and he was telling me, this was about a month ago, about having to wait and wait for a really large order, a couple of tons of silver. And at that level, you work in 1,000-ounce bars, okay? Mm-hmm. We're not talking like eagles and maples. At the wholesale level, you deal in 1,000-ounce bars, not 1-ounce coins. And Andy had an order for a couple metric tons of 1,000-ounce bars back in July that when it was purchased and when it was invoiced and set to be shipped, contained all of the serial numbers. When it finally came, you know, like a month later, none of the bars matched. Okay. They didn't have anyone there near the same serial numbers that they told they were going to get. I mean, there are all these things telling you there's a pretty significant shortage. And of course, that's true because, you know, the vast majority of silver that's produced every year goes for industrial purposes, you know, solar panels, you know, computers, things like that. We already know that silver mine production is down this year because Mexico and Peru were both offline for a couple of months and they're still struggling, you know, to get back up to their normal level. So what are we going to do this year? 800 million ounces, maybe less. That'd be down at least 10% from last year. Then you've got the purported alleged silver going into something like the SLV, which in the volume that is suggested that's going in could really only logically be like future delivery receipts, warehouse receipts, things like that. And it's pretty easy to see where there's kind of a shortage currently in silver. Now, does that eventually lead to the word you used was default on the COMEX? I'd be really surprised if you ever reach that point. There's been precedent in the past where a certain form of futures trading like main potatoes just simply stops and they cash settle everybody out at a certain price for all the futures contracts. And then price is discovered someplace else instead. For the global market, that's probably what's coming at some point. But again, I learned a long time ago to not sit here and say, that's going to happen in September. Because you know, the banks always manage to find a way, at least they have thus far, to kind of hold things together. But it's important for regular investors to understand that the entire, we'll call it global pricing scheme, price is determined often through the trading of derivative contracts in London and New York. And then there are banks that have to manage physical delivery at that price. And the scheme over time has levered the actual underlying metal. Some say, I mean, even Jeffrey Christian of CPM Group in front of, you know, that congressional committee 10 years ago said it could be as much as 100 ounces to one, 100 derivative obligations, future obligations versus every one physical ounce. And so I don't know if that it's more than 10 to 1 probably. When finally you get to a point where you've got 10 different entities or 100 different entities demanding delivery of the same physical ounce, that's when everything changes. You know, we're closer to that point than we were last year at this time, but last thing I'm going to do is try to say, but that's going to be on Halloween, you know? That's just the frailty of the system and how overextended it's gotten.
Interesting. So once we see, let's say, the system kind of kick loose, Eric speaks quite a bit about the 15 to 1 gold to silver ratio. What are your thoughts on that ratio? And do you think we could see something like that?
Yeah, I've been asked that a lot over time. Why is it that historically the ratio was 15 to 1 or 12 to 1? You know, and people say, well, that's the amount of silver in the world's crust, or that's the ratio that we mine it, whatever. But that seemed to be the historic ratio. And then what did we get to back in March? Like 120 to 1? You know, these extremes. And the only explanation that I've ever said is that's due to the pricing scheme. You know, maybe not that derivatives are that far out of whack, you know, six times or something like that. But on a basic level, maybe that's what it is. That because, you know, that the silver pricing structure is levered six times greater than the gold pricing structure, maybe. And that's why instead of 15 to 1, you have 90 to 1. Do you see what I'm saying with the math?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the fact that that's gotten so out of whack over the years is a function of this digital derivative pricing scheme we've had since 1975. And so what Eric is postulating is that if that scheme fails because of this physical demand brought out by all these things that are going on in the world, forces a deleveraging of the system and something that moves us back closer toward a physical pricing, then naturally that gold-silver ratio would revert back to, you know, what it has always been historically for centuries. I think that's the basis of what he's driving at, and he's pretty sure that's where we're going. Again, the hard part is saying that that's where we're going by a certain date. I don't think, and I've long thought, that this can't continue indefinitely, the system as it is. But, you know, when it ends is anybody's guess. You know, it's like the old Hemingway thing, right, Tom? How do you go broke? Gradually and then subtly.
Suddenly all at once.
Yeah. This system is fracturing. When will it break? Slowly and then all at once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think one of the other, let's say, tailwinds for this space is we're finally starting to see some institutional investors come in. And
right,
you were speaking a little bit about new investors to the SLV, which was quite interesting on top of, let's say, the announcement that made a lot of news about Warren Buffett buying into Barrick. But if you remember, why don't you tell us some of the names that are really starting to pile into SLV as well?
Well, yeah, there are a lot of institutional names. I think people have noticed that. Again, if you've got a Bloomberg terminal, which I don't, but a lot of times you can pull that up. You know, they have that, all the recent filings, what are they, 13Ks or whatever they are, where they list all the holders. And you have everybody piling in. You can see that through the SEC filings, what are they, 13Ks that show all the major holders. And it's like BlackRock and, you know, and all these other institutions that are now.
Morgan Stanley, UBS, Royal Bank of Canada.
Yeah. Which, again, what are they buying? I mean, those are all, a lot of those are authorized participants in the SLV. And the authorized participants are the only ones that can actually withdraw metal from the SLV. You and I can't. All the SLV does for you and I is gives us a short-term trading exposure to price. But you and I, if we buy SLV, we don't own jack. We just own paper. We just own exposure to price. But these a lot of those big banks, they're listed in the prospectus as authorized participants, and the authorized participants are the ones that can actually redeem baskets of shares for physical. So that's interesting when you look at it that way. But on the institutional side, this is really important stuff because, I mean, you follow precious metals. I follow precious metals. We love precious metals. We understand why we own it. But, Tom, we're like not even 0.1% of the investment world, right?
Mm-hmm.
All of us. We understand the meaning behind it, the importance of it. The major institutions, major hedge funds, pension funds are like, man, they don't mess around with the precious metals. They don't. And they don't own mining shares either. So when somebody like Warren Buffett, who's kind of their bell cow, the Oracle of Omaha, you know, when all of a sudden he shifts gears and buys just one mining company, Barrick, that's like a flare going up. And all these institutions go, wait a second, hold on just a minute. Why is he buying a mining company? And then they start to look around at the sector and they go, wait a second, this whole sector, what other sector has rapidly growing earnings and increasing dividends in a COVID world? None. Nobody. And so you get what I've often called the rule. I name it after Rick Rule because he was the first person that told me about this a couple years ago. In 1980, at the end of, you know, all of that, you know, negative real rates got to 5% negative, and gold went from $100 to $900, and a lot of mining shares went from 30 cents to $30, that kind of stuff. That was a bubble, and that's where maybe we'll get there again someday soon. But total institutional asset allocation to the precious metals and the mining shares reached 8%, which is a lot when you think about it. For the longest time, you know, while you've been wandering in the desert for the last 5 or 6 years, it's been under 1%. So when Warren Buffett shoots off a flare like that, if we just go from 1% to 2%, God forbid 3, think of the amount of cash that that represents. I mean, what's the market cap of just, you know, what's Apple now? $2 trillion? What's the entire market cap of the GLD? $200 billion? I mean, any kind of institutional fund flow into our sector represents a lot of cash chasing what is really a finite amount of investment opportunities. It will start with the majors because that's what old Warren bought. And already you're seeing on a relative basis over the last 2 weeks, the GDX outperforming the GDXJ. But as things continue to go and as more money flows in, the flow will go from the majors to the juniors and then to the exploration companies. And if we start going from 1% to 2% global asset allocation to 3 and 4, I mean, that's just a really big wad of cash chasing a really small amount of investment opportunities. And that's going to be really good for us. And that's where it looks like we're headed.
Yeah, that chain reaction that we're going to see is, I think, something that everybody in this space is definitely waiting for. Craig, I want to be respectful of your time, but I would like to get your thoughts on where the dollar is headed. Obviously, we know that there's many different theories out there, and last night we saw the DXY dip below the defined resistance level of 92, but I'd like to get your thoughts on what we could see, a weaker or stronger dollar.
Well, keep in mind a couple of things, and I advise everybody that's listening to us to remember this stuff. One, when we measure the dollar index, we're always measuring it. I mean, that's against a basket of other currencies, right? And they're all fiat currencies. So it's just the dollar versus primarily the euro. It's like 60% euro, and then you throw in all the rest. And as we record this today, the dollar euro specifically got to 120 and then immediately fell backward. And that then turned the dollar index up from those lows that you mentioned and all that jazz. So that's the first thing to remember. We're comparing fiat to fiat. Next up in that important line of stuff about the dollar is to understand that the Fed needs a weaker dollar. Okay. They are trying desperately to spark inflation. Powell's speech was all about that last week, how once deflation and deflationary expectations set in, it's really hard to break that cycle. And he was talking about Japan. And he said conventional Fed policy tools don't work, which kind of should lead you to think maybe some unconventional Fed policy tools may be coming over the horizon. You know, the old adage is you don't fight the Fed. A rising dollar is generally disinflationary. A falling dollar is inflationary. So the Fed now wants a weaker dollar, not sharply weaker. I mean, it's down 10% since QE to infinity was announced at the end of March. Probably won't go down another 10% the next 5 months, but that's definitely they want it to go that way. And then lastly, and this is really important for people to understand too, the generalists out there, the chart readers, the people that write articles for MarketWatch and stuff like that, they're fallback explanation when they on a daily basis feel they have to write about gold and why gold went up or down is just to say, well, the dollar went up or down. That's just like a default position because it gives them some copy and fills up the article. Yeah, it can be kind of a tailwind or a headwind right now in periods of low volume with most traders still on vacation in the summer doldrums. You can get a more direct correlation, but over time, it's not uncommon to see gold and the dollar moving up together or down together, but not on a tick for tick basis daily. If that were the case, you mentioned the dollar being 92, the dollar index. Well, the last time the dollar index was this low was, you know, in 2018. Mm-hmm. Where was gold in 2018? About 1300. So if gold just is always an inverse of the dollar, why is gold not $1,300 now? So one word of caution is for investors out there is to not think that gold is just simply an inverse of the dollar index. It can provide a headwind or a tailwind. But in the end of the day, if anything is an inverse or a direct relationship over time, it's that level of real interest rates, inflation adjusted interest rates. those are what are going to continue to get more and more negative. When you start guaranteeing an inflation-adjusted loss on something like the 10-year Treasury note, that 10-year Treasury note is the foundational asset, you know, tier one asset for institutions around the world. If you start guaranteeing a loss on that of 2% a year in purchasing power, all of a sudden gold as a tier one asset looks pretty good. And that's all part of why that's such an important relationship for gold. And I think the Fed is putting that plan in place to make that a permanent thing here for the next several years. And if that's the case, then this bull market's going to be a permanent thing for the next several years too.
Perfect. Well, I think that's a great way to wrap up, Craig. Why don't you tell everybody a little bit about what you have on offer over at tfmetalsreport.com?
Well, thank you, Tom. Yeah, the site's been around for 10 years, and it's a fantastic online community because we've got people from all around the world in all political stripes, but we treat each other with respect, and there are no bomb throwing. You know, it's not like a YouTube comment section or something like that, because we all know we're in the same boat. And it doesn't matter if, you know, you're red state or blue state, or, you know, to use the U.S. way of looking at it. I mean, we're all going, you know, circling the drain with the dollar and the, you know, the deficit and the debt at this point. So we all know we're out here to kind of help each other. What I do every day, I write a post every morning, and then we record a summary podcast every afternoon. A lot of people use the information I provide. I try not to tell people to trade because I think that's really risky business. But a lot of people maybe use my analysis to maybe time their physical purchases. You know, if we can recognize that we're going to pull back in August as we did, you know, maybe you can save yourself a dollar or two the next time you buy 20 Eagles or Maples. And if you can do that consistently, well, that more than pays for your $15 a month subscription cost. So I think what we do is pretty valuable. I think the site's pretty valuable, and I just encourage everybody to check it out. You can sign up and just go month by month if you want, tfmetalsreport.com.
Yeah, and you guys put out a lot of great content there.
Thank you.
Also, TF Metals on Twitter, correct?
Yep, just at TF Metals. I don't even know what 27,000 or something followers, which is just so strange. We didn't really talk much about my background, but I've been doing this for 10 years now. And though I started out as a stockbroker 30 years ago, I never intended to become some kind of precious metals analyst. I mean, I'm just a guy that just runs a small business, and suddenly I know people all around the world. And so I still just amazed sometimes at the fact I'm sitting here talking to you, or the fact that I can tweet something and it immediately gets read by 27,000 people. I just think is just bizarre. But yeah, at TF Metals is the Twitter handle, and I'm on there quite a bit too.
Excellent, Craig. Well, thank you very much for your time today.
You too, Tom. All the best, and thank you for having me on.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.
Think you understand the junior mining sector, and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people, hit the bid.
How violent that term could be, it actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw material. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?